This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine and your host for Trumpet Hour. We have a special show for you today. We're going to talk about the future. What will the future be like? How much do you even think about that? It's the subject of a lot of books and movies and setting events in the immediate future and the distant future. On one hand, you have very optimistic views of a high-tech world with widespread prosperity, man's problems solved through innovation and scientific discovery. And on the other hand, you have more frightening views of warfare destroying us, or people returning to scarcity and survivalism. Well, on today's Trumpet Hour, we're going to take up the question of what the future will be like in a very specific way. We want to talk about the question of sustainability. How can we live on this planet in a way that will make it a better place for our children and our grandchildren and for generations beyond that? It's a really important question, and I think it's a sobering question, a very sobering question, when you look at the way society operates today. It's not something that many people tend to think about because, well, they're pretty caught up in just making it through the present moment. But it is something that we should think about. Another problem is that it tends to get really political. There are people who use issues of sustainability to basically amass political power. In society today, you have two camps, basically, those who prioritize economic growth and development and those who prioritize environmental concerns. There's very strong, very heated arguments on both sides of that. Well, in this program, we want to try to steer clear of the politics and just talk about some basic facts. We want to look at the facts about our present world that are not sustainable and speculate about possible solutions to these problems that we might see implemented in the future. Again, I think it's important to consider the legacy that we'll leave for the generations to come after us. It's sobering to think about it, but it's also very inspiring to have your mind on solutions and possibilities for the future. And I've assembled a panel to discuss several aspects of this question today. Robert Morley, besides being a writer for the Trumpet Magazine, he worked as an environmental scientist for URS Corporation in Los Angeles, one of the world's largest environmental engineering companies. He focused on soil remediation related to hydrocarbon contamination and chlorinated solvents and assisted on some water remediation projects. He also currently teaches science at Herbert W. Armstrong College. Hello, Robert.
Good to be here.
And Jeremiah Jacques, he is also a Trumpet writer. He often writes on science and scientific subject matters, including articles on solar power and green energy trends, reforestation projects, biology, climate change, developments in astronomy, and more. He's currently researching how to add a small wind turbine to help power his house. Hello, Jeremiah.
Hello there.
And we also have Daniel Westerbaan. He teaches science at Imperial Academy. He has a master's in mechanical engineering from the University of Waterloo. He studied the welding of advanced steels for use in the automotive industry. He worked as a mechanical engineer researching hybrid and electrical vehicles. And he was part of a team that designed and built two cars powered by hydrogen fuel cells. What will the future be like? How can we ensure that the planet will be a better place for generations to come? There are several aspects of life today that ignore this question. Basically, the way things we do things is not sustainable. Our food production and agricultural industry is killing our soil. Our transportation industry is fueled by non-renewable fuel sources that are going to dry up eventually. We're depleting freshwater aquifers at an alarming rate, and it doesn't look like we have any intention of slowing down until, well, there's nothing left to take. Fundamentally, our world is built on a taking mindset. It looks at the resources of the earth essentially as an infinite supply of wealth to mine, to extract, to consume. It's an exploitative system. We put off the questions about the limits on supply or realities about resources being finite and the fact that what we're doing can't go on forever. Essentially, we put our faith in our ability to come up with new solutions, new technologies that will enable us to continue taking and taking and taking. We have an enormous amount of trust in human ingenuity to solve everything. But in nearly every case, the solutions we come up with are worse than the problems they're supposed to solve. Let me just give you one example. The world uses 85 million barrels of oil every day. We are totally addicted to oil. Oil is cheap. It is extremely efficient. It's a very powerful source of energy. But it also has some problems. Besides the fact that it's very dirty and polluting, and the fact that it gives power to some pretty terrible people on this earth who possess it, it's also limited. We can't keep using it forever. So to this point, our solution has been to exploit oil in more difficult to reach places and more expensive methods and environmentally risky and even dangerous sources. We're getting it out of the deep oceans, which, you know, that's fantastic, except when it creates massive oil spills. We're getting it from tar sands, a very costly process that takes a lot of energy to harvest and to convert into a usable form. We're getting natural gas through hydraulic fracturing or fracking. And that produces 80 million gallons of toxic wastewater per well. Some scientists say that's the reason why our offices here in Oklahoma are suddenly getting shaken by earthquakes all the time. Now, not only do these solutions have nasty side effects, they also ignore the fact that we're still dealing with a finite resource. No matter how ingenious you get in extracting it, at some point, it's still going to be exhausted. So we can safely say that looking into the future, something has to change. The way we're doing it can't keep going on. We absolutely know the future is going to be different because it is absolutely impossible to keep doing what we're doing. Now, what makes the question all the more interesting and inspiring is this important fact. Just like everything else we look at on Trumpet Hour, we're going to look at this from a biblical perspective. And if you look at the prophecies of the Bible, you see there's coming a point very soon when man's mistreatment of this planet will come to an end, and human governments will be supplanted and replaced by the rule of Jesus Christ, the King of Kings. He's going to start over from the ground up. He's going to build a new civilization that really works and that is, in fact, sustainable. In fact, the prophecies of the world tomorrow that he will create show that this world isn't going to decline. It's not going to get worse and worse. It's actually going to get better and better. So when we talk about solutions to the problems in the world today, these aren't just pie-in-the-sky fantasies. We know that in the very near future, the questions of what the future will be like and how can we ensure that our planet is going to be a better place for our children and our grandchildren and for generations beyond that, these will be vital questions front and center in public policy, and they will be questions for which we will find real answers. So as we discuss these things, we're going to try to bring some informed speculation to issues that really will be solved in the near future. We're going to address these questions by looking at some specific areas: the use of soil and water, waste management, energy production, technology, transportation, population management. And as we look at each of these areas, we're going to start by surveying some of the problems with what we do today and discuss some ways we might be able to find solutions that are sustainable in pursuit of a world that really does get better and better. We're going to start by talking about soil. Soil is the foundation of everything. We come from it. When we die, we return to it. Fundamentally, it's where we get everything. Practically, it's the source of our food. If the soil is unhealthy, we're unhealthy. The way that we're treating our soil today is totally unsustainable. So to talk about some of the problems, we will go to Robert.
Yeah, soils today, if you look at our agricultural practices, I think there are very few people who would argue that they are sustainable on a long-term basis. We use all kinds of mechanized, mass-produced farming techniques that are designed to produce as much food as possible in the most limited space available. So we have designed a whole system based upon forcing the land to its very, very limits. And we see this in the amounts of fertilizer that are dumped on farming fields, the amount of pesticides, the fact that we're producing and using ever-increasing types of genetically modified crops designed to resist these herbicides so that they can produce more and more and more. And the result is we are facing a situation now where a lot of scientists are looking at farmland across the United States and across the world and finding that it is degrading, and it's degrading at a very rapid rate. And when you look at the world, it's actually, some of the numbers are pretty startling, especially when you look at areas that have much higher rainfall than the United States. If you go around the mid-tropics, you go down to countries like Brazil or Indonesia, they're losing massive amounts of farmland each year. And their agricultural practices are still based out of what humans were probably doing 2,000 years ago, with slash and burn agriculture, and land is being destroyed. So when we look at our soils, what we end up with is we're producing more food, but food with less nutrients in it, poor quality food. And the worry is at some point we might cross the Rubicon and reach a tipping point where the soils, despite increasing amounts of pesticide and herbicide and fertilizer application, just aren't going to be able to yield the food that we need.
So we've got to do something different. And really, fundamentally, it has to begin with treating the soil as something that you have to replenish. You can't take and take and take. You have to put back into it.
Yeah, absolutely. Soil is, as far as humans are concerned, pretty much a non-renewable resource. It does regenerate. They can be regenerated. But once it's gone, it can take years and years, if it's left to itself, to basically heal. And what's really interesting, I find interesting about this topic, is the Bible talks a lot about soil and animal husbandry and how to treat the land and land Sabbaths and rests. And when you start looking into how God designed agriculture to take place, you find that it is really a system that works on cycles, and it's a system that leads to improving your soil quality over time, building the soil quality over time so it produces greater and greater harvests, a better tasting, more nutritious food over time. And I think that's one of the very amazing things about creation. As much as we abuse the environment sometimes, God has it designed where it can be healed, it can be repaired. And there's a lot of ways that you can go about doing that. And there's some really cool things that are actually happening today that people are starting to implement to try to, they see this problem and try to fix this problem. We've seen this whole movement for organic foods. We've seen organic farming techniques, and I think that's part of it. But unfortunately, the way the world, the way we've pushed our land so far, I think in the future we're going to have to take some pretty aggressive measures to fix the damage that's being done. And one of the tools that I feel might be used much more heavily in the future is the field of bioremediation, and using the natural bacteria and fungus and organisms that are in the soil to rebuild that soil. If you were to go out into a field and just pick up a handful of dirt, go under some trees in your backyard and pick up a handful of dirt, most people probably don't realize this, but you're picking up probably in the range of tens of billions, probably even more, cells, living organisms in there, millions of bacteria, billions of fungal cells. I think that Paul Stamides, he's one of the foremost researchers on mushrooms. And he says that when you go out in a forest and you walk in a forest and you take a step, if you were to lay all that, the little tiny cells, fungal cells, end to end on that footprint, you'd reach 300 miles, just to give you an idea of the life that's in soils. And that life is there for a reason. It's there to recycle nutrients. God designed it that way, to build up soil so that they could produce more. They could take material that was already grown, can break it down, get nitrogen out of the air, get that into the soils, and basically turn. Soil is a living organism. It's not just dead. A lot of people call it dirt, but it's not dirt. It's alive. I think that encouraging the use of the microbes, what's there, facilitating, helping promote their growth, can really go wonders to heal the land. And we see this happening all the time. if you look at like oil spills, for example, Exxon Valdez, everybody remembers that when that was spilled up on the coast of there, Alaska. What did they do? That was when they first, one of the first times they went out there and tried to treat a lot of these oil spills with bacteria. They put bacteria on the oils to eat up the oils and break it down. But since that time, they've made huge strides with the use of bacteria and fungus to, you know, fix pollution, to break down pollution, to clean soils and make it usable again. And on top of that, there's whole fields developing of inoculating soils with the right bacteria to make them healthy, to make them more productive. And I think this is one field that just holds so much potential. Even when it comes to nuclear waste, problems with cleaning up radioactivity. We just had a couple years ago Fukushima, the earthquake off of Japan that sent a tidal wave in and destroyed that nuclear plant, and nuclear radiation was released all over that section of Japan. I think they cordoned off about an 8-kilometer zone around that, maybe a little bit more than that. If you look at Chernobyl, what's going on there, you can see that bacteria and fungus in particular can have a pretty big role in helping to clean that up. For instance, Paul Simides, that fellow I mentioned earlier, he's consulted with the Defense Department over biological warfare and using fungus and bacteria and the certain enzymes they create to combat biological warfare and chemical warfare. He's also has a lot of applications that he's pushing for using mushrooms and fungus to treat even nuclear waste. And, you know, one of his proposals for Fukushima was to go in and just basically mulch that area of all the trees, all the life, put down wood chips and inoculate it with fungus. And he says, you let those fungus go on that, on the nuclear, they're nuclear radiation concentrators, certain species of fungus. They'll concentrate the cesium and strontium, all these different nuclear elements at rates of 10,000 times whatever it is in the background radiation. So you can inoculate them, have them grow them, harvest them up, take care of them or take them off, treat them properly, and you can remove the land of nuclear radiation, make it usable again. You know, it's still a process, he says, that could take years, but at least maybe we're not dealing with the thousands of years that it takes, or tens of thousands of years for the half-lives of a lot of these radioactive elements to decay.
It's remarkable how much resiliency there is within the natural world. You know, one of the things about the use of soil that I just find so awesome to think about, you mentioned the laws with respect to the land Sabbath, where there's a certain respect for the limits of what you can get from the soil. There's a certain respect for, you know, basically 1 year out of seven to say, look, let it rest. Just step back instead of just trying to take and take and take and take, recognizing that in that seventh year, as part of a comprehensive plan of agriculture that includes animal husbandry, that's ensuring that there are organic materials being put into the soil regularly. But that 1 year out of seven, it's just, look, let the animals do their thing, rebuild the soil. And that's going to preserve its long-term health. It's going to prevent this sort of exploitative mindset that just wants to take as much as it can without ever giving back anything into it. But putting that together with the prophecy of every man under his vine and under his fig tree, and this essentially the biblical model of land distribution and land ownership kind of underpinning the economy of tomorrow's world, you have families who have a vested interest in preserving the health of the soil on which they live and trying to ensure that it's healthful for their children, for their grandchildren, and beyond. They have a vested interest in ensuring that it's the land that they have control over and stewardship over is going to be viable in the long run.
Yeah, there is going to be a very different mindset. There needs to be a very different mindset when it comes to managing land. You know, right now, so much of it is this exploitative mentality, just get everything we can and move on to the next piece. And you can look at history and you can see how that's even led to the downfall of many, many cultures. You can look in, you know, Mesoamerica, a lot of those, the Aztecs, the Incas, some of those cultures down there, they collapsed when they destroyed their soils. You can go to other cultures around the world, the same thing. They fell apart. Empires that were vibrant and producing and powerful, you know, in very short periods of time disappeared. They absolutely disappeared because they destroyed their soils. And you know, some scientists today, I think probably about, it was about a year ago or a year and a half ago, there was a study that was done. I remember we wrote about it at the time. But there was some very prominent scientists saying, hey, look, our soils are facing, you know, a crisis here. We don't know, we've never pushed them this far beyond. We've never killed the micro life the way we are doing with pesticides and herbicides like we've done in the past. We could be pushing ourselves towards our own extinction type. This was Absolutely. The kind of language they were talking.
Yeah, it's I don't know how there would be any other outcome when you have an industrial model where a company really isn't concerned about anything but the bottom line, the short term gain and what they can make from it short term, and they're not really looking at. They have no motive to preserve its long term fertility. It's just not in the business model,
right? Especially if they can just move on to the next piece.
So soil, obviously, hugely important. Let's talk now about water. And what are we doing with our water source today that is not sustainable?
Yeah, big water issues are becoming some of the most important issues in this world. Even if you just look at what's going on with California right now with the massive drought, they're saying it's the worst drought in perhaps 1,000 years or even more in California now. And for the first time, they're doing water rationing in ways they haven't in the past. They're just basically telling farmers in some regions, you can't use water. Basically, they're putting the cities in front of the farmers. But many places around the world have had much worse dramatic water issues than the United States. I think there's about 783 million people in this world that don't have access to clean water on a regular basis. Almost, you know, it's 750 million people that don't have access to just simple, basic clean water, things we take for granted, just going to their tap and turning it on and being able to drink water here in America. It's not that way for a lot of people around this world. I think there's about 2.5 billion people that don't have access to sanitation, which is very closely related to having clean water available to you. So we see millions of people each year. I think the United Nations estimated like 8 million people died last year because they don't have access to good water, or they are die because they get sick from drinking polluted water or contaminated water. So this is a huge issue for people around the world. And I think going forward, it's going to become a bigger issue as populations grow, as we've seen an increase in natural disasters and weather-related problems. Water issues come to the fore. There's even, you know, if you look at investors around the world, for the first time over the last couple of years, products are coming on the market because people see that there's going to be shortages at some time, that being able to have access to water, to own water rights, is going to become a way for them to make money because there's going to be shortages. So this is, I think, one of these issues that are going to be on people's minds going forward much more than it is today.
Meanwhile, as those millions of people that you're describing don't have access to clean water, in other parts of the world, we're wasting water on a massive scale through, like I mentioned, the use of technology like fracking, 80 million gallons of toxic wastewater per well. Even our sewage system and that type of thing, it tends to ignore the, it turns something that could be a perfectly drinkable resource into something that's very toxic and unusable. So these are unsustainable practices.
Yeah, absolutely. If you look at water distribution around the world, it is very uneven, as you said. There's certain parts of the world that are extremely blessed with water. You look at North America, you look at what we have in the Great Lakes, for example, you don't find that anywhere else in the world. You don't find populations centered right over the most abundant, largest supplies of fresh water on the planet. And for most of the world, they don't have that privilege of having water basically right on their doorstep. I mean, when it comes to transporting water in the United States and Canada, you don't have to go very far to get that water to your doorstep. But you can contrast that with countries like China and a lot of places in Africa. Those are big problems.
What about the way that we treat aquifers? We have beautiful, fantastic aquifers that we're depleting at a rapid rate, and essentially treating this as another resource, almost like oil, that we're going to exploit basically until it's dried up.
Yeah, what's the one thing that separates the American deserts from, say, the Gobi Desert or the Sahara Desert? It's the fact that underneath all that sand in America's West, there's the Ogallala Aquifer. There's other aquifers that farmers and people have been able to tap into. We're able to drill down a well 300 feet and have abundant source of water and one that gushes. I mean, for many, many years, just gushed and gushed and gushed. And this, too, has been in the news recently over the last couple of years. I know we've written about it, too. There's now parts of the United States where that aquifer is, for all intents and purposes, dry. You can put a well down in the ground, but you don't get water. And the recharge rate for a lot of these aquifers is very, very slow, beyond a human's lifetime. Some of these deep aquifers, they recharge at rates of like 1,000 years. You know, we're talking about inches per hundreds of years it'll rise. But the Ogallala has allowed America to really become an agricultural superpower. I mean, it has really allowed agriculture to take place in areas that without that groundwater, it wouldn't be there. And now we're starting to see problems like they're having in California, having to tell their farmers, you just can't farm this year. Sorry, there's not enough water. Groundwater has been dropping at rates so fast in California that the ground is caving in. From satellite imagery, they can measure the fall in certain regions is being measured in inches per year. In some areas, I think it's fallen close to a foot in a year over recent years. These are very real issues that we're starting to have to face today.
Our long-term solutions, how we use this life-giving resource, have to account for it. It has to be sustainable.
Absolutely. And one of the things that can give you hope is that God designed this planet with a natural built-in system for purifying water and providing water. It's called the water cycle. And a lot of people probably learn about this in high school. But it's the natural way that God has designed for water to be purified and distributed. Basically, the oceans, which are salt water, you know, you have the evaporation, and the evaporation of water goes up into the atmosphere, moves over land, it rains down, and you get clean water. You get water that was salty turned into fresh water, or you get water that was polluted turned into fresh water. And that solves a lot of problems. Given enough time, you have a source of fresh water. It's there whenever it rains. And the Bible talks about this concept in the future. It has a lot on the water cycle. It has a lot on the fact that in the future, people will be blessed with rain in due season, as the scripture talks about it, or having the rain when you need it. And underpinning the Bible, the one concept underpinning, you know, running through the Bible from beginning to end is this concept of cause and effect. And God talks a lot about blessings for obedience. And one of those blessings he talks about is sending the rain when you need it. And sending and causing it to rain on one piece of land and not another piece of land, depending on, you know, are you obeying God? Are you following his laws or not? And I think the water cycle solves a lot of those issues. But still, like you said, I mean, there are other factors that we are going to have to be working towards cleaning our water. Water is polluted, and, you know, and some of that will have to be fixed.
So it's almost like just looking at those places where God... Basically, he refers to rainfall in its due season, and that the right amount of water falling on our crops and so on as being a blessing for obedience. It's almost like the climatic problems that we're experiencing today are a result of disobedience, and we're tapping into aquifers and we're trying to find ways around what essentially is a curse. And once we're doing things the right way, we're not experiencing that curse, then maybe the need for tapping into those non-renewable water resources isn't going to be there.
I think you're absolutely right. I remember a few years ago when I was working out in California, we were trying to find a new water well field for the city of Hollywood. And in that city, their wells were dropping so rapidly, they were going dry. But the bigger problem that they had at that time was that the wells were drawing in pollution from all over the place. So as they were drawing water to the wells, they were sucking in polluted water from elsewhere, and it was making their water undrinkable. And our task was to find an area in the city of Hollywood where we could put down wells and find clean water. And you know what? We couldn't do it. We could not do it. We were going down 800 feet, and we could not find water that was clean. It had been contaminated by industry, local industry, polluting the groundwater. And so what does the city do? It has to bring in clean water, rainwater, and mix it and dilute it down so, you know, the pollutants are within drinkable standards. But the pollution's there. It's still there. And that's just one example of, you know, hopefully in the future, well, I know in the future we won't be doing those kind of things because it's not sustainable.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour. We're talking about the future and how the unsustainable practices of today's world are going to have to be corrected in order to make them sustainable in the future. Coming up, we're going to talk about waste management, about energy production. Later in the program, technology, transportation. We'll get to that right after a break. We'll be back in a moment.
Is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
This is our program about the future. We're discussing some of the problems with the way we do things in modern society, practices that are not sustainable and that will have to change in the future, and then what we can do to correct those things. How can we make sure the planet will be better for our children and grandchildren? Well, the next question we're going to look at is that of waste management. Our society today is very wasteful. We produce a lot of trash. We don't really seem to care where it goes or what kind of damage it causes. This is a big subject. We're just going to scratch the surface here. But there are two main components. The first is just the trash that we make. The second is human waste. And we'll just talk about some of the problems and the way we handle these things today. First of all, modern society produces an enormous amount of trash. Some of it is biodegradable, some of it can be recycled, but a lot of it is essentially permanent trash. Certain kinds of plastics, construction and demolition waste, electrical and electronic waste, appliances, TVs, computers, and that type of thing. We also make a lot of hazardous waste with paints and chemicals, light bulbs, fluorescent tubes, spray cans, fertilizer, toxic waste in the form of pesticides, herbicides, fungicides, and medical waste. So think about it. You're thirsty, you grab a water bottle, you quench your thirst, you feel better, then you throw the water bottle away. The bottle is basically going to last forever. That is an unsustainable model of consumption. The Environmental Protection Agency says the average American produces about 4.4 pounds of garbage a day, 1,600 pounds a year. 1,600 pounds, that's, what is that, 3/4 of a ton per person per year. The trash produced in America could bury more than 990,000 football fields under 6 feet of waste. And Americans aren't even the top garbage producers in the world. In Mexico, the average household produces 30% more garbage than in America. Waste management is a huge industry. And in terms of unsustainability, it starts with the fact that we transport so much of it, often multiple times, usually over long distances, to various trash processing or disposal sites. Then you have these industrial trash processing facilities, and they're just constantly working to engineer ways to deal with this waste without creating hazards to public health or safety, looking for ways around contaminating groundwater or creating breeding grounds for flies or other insects. We end up with landfills, dumping waste into an area. We compact it with large machines. We seal it with plastic. We cover it with dirt. Most of the stuff in landfills is packaging. Fast food containers and so on. It's plastic packaging and bags. You have a lot of disposable diapers and styrofoam. Despite their best efforts, there are several problems with pollution associated with landfills. They end up using a lot of chemicals to cover up odors. Nobody wants to live next to a landfill, right? Are there going to be landfills in tomorrow's world? I don't think so. That is not a sustainable model. I think in the world tomorrow, we're going to have to be very attentive to the waste that we create. A sustainable system simply will not create waste that doesn't go back into the cycle. I don't see how we could be creating on any kind of a mass scale at all non-biodegradable waste. A landfill isn't sustainable because eventually you run out of land. We don't want to have our grandchildren having to deal with our waste, right? We want to teach our children how to live their lives in a way that doesn't generate waste. Your thoughts, gentlemen?
Yeah, the idea of biodegradable, I think, is an important one. If we just go back a couple of generations, I think the amount of biodegradable material that we're using is probably a lot higher than it is today. So we've probably gone in the wrong direction that way. But I think most recently we started a trend back that way. If you think of the shopping bags at the grocery store, those used to be, you know, the bane of environmentalists. But now even a lot of those are biodegradable. They break down much faster than they have in the past. So I think we will have a world that perhaps has some of these, you know, plastics and things. Maybe there won't be as much. Maybe we won't be using them as often. But when we do, I think they'll be designed in a way that they won't impact the environment long term. And I think that's probably one of the big issues with a lot of the materials we use today.
Yeah, it makes me think about just how much we would use disposable goods. I mean, even with a shopping bag, you know, if you can easily get a bag that's going to last, that you can use for, you know, repeatedly, and there is no trash, there is no waste that comes as a result of that. That seems like the kind of thinking that you would want to promote heavily to reduce the amount of trash you make.
Yeah, if you even think of not too long ago, we're all using paper bags. Maybe that's not as good for the trees. We're cutting down a lot of trees to do that, but at least they went back to the earth.
Honestly, I think that the issue of trash is it's just going to be something that's on our mind quite a lot, in the sense of, like, you know, do we need this product, or do, you know, if you're going to package something, is there a way to do it where you're not generating something that's going to be hanging around? That the amount of trash that each household produces, a lot of it they're going to try to find ways to recycle that back into the household, or there's just not going to be a system where you put something into a box, you set it outside your house, and somebody comes and takes it and hauls it off, and you never have to think about it again. It seems like there's something that's fundamentally unsustainable about that whole model. As convenient as it is, it also creates a lot of problems down the way. Now, human waste, of course, human waste is dangerous if it isn't handled properly. It's filled with pathogens. There's bacteria and viruses and protozoa and worms in it that can really make us sick. And in a lot of human history, it's been mishandled, and it's spread disease and created other problems. It's especially dangerous if it gets into our water supply. So our current solution is we flush it. We flush it along with what is essentially clean drinking water into a sewer system. Now, the problems associated with this include the fact that it requires running water and power and a comprehensive infrastructure that can break down. If you've ever been in an office building, when the water stops flowing, you know that things get really nasty really quickly. But also, sewage is a lot to deal with. We deal with it in waste treatment facilities by mixing in toxic chemicals to kill off those pathogens. And then when we pump that whole thing into rivers and oceans, and that can have a really deleterious effect on marine life. So looking at solutions, I think you have to start with Deuteronomy 23 and verse 13. There's actually a law in the Bible where God told us to bury our human waste. And this one law, that one verse, basically put the Israelites far ahead of the rest of the world in terms of sanitation and avoiding the problems with unsanitary handling of human waste. It's actually been proven that human waste treated through a hot composting process can safely improve soil quality. That sounds like a good solution. I do think it's interesting to think about this kind of a solution being used on a mass scale. I think, you know, once population density reaches a certain point, you are going to need some kind of a system. It's not just necessarily a matter of each person taking care of his own waste, but we're going to have to be educated in this, aren't we?
I looked into some farms already that are attempting to use what they call biosolids. That's after the waste has gone through one phase of treatment. And it's a fairly popular practice among some agricultural groups in Japan. And it's even catching on here in the States a little bit. And so it seems like a complicated science at this point, and there's still some controversy on both sides of it. But I believe that just from the progress that has been made toward that area, that it shows that there is a lot of promise for coming to a place where we could find the right balance and learn how to just make that a cyclical part of a process once again, instead of just this endless problem that's just waste we have to somehow get rid of.
It seems like one of the biggest challenges is making sure we keep it out of water supplies.
Yeah.
Like throughout history and even recently, you know, you hear where there's been a sewage release. And I mean, that's one of the biggest reasons we have to put chlorine in our water today. Why do cities have to, why are we drinking chlorine? Well, it's because of human and animal waste runoff that's getting into the waters. That's a huge part of it. So if we can address those issues, I think that starts to go a long way towards even impacting where we get our drinkable water from.
So let's go ahead and transition into talking about energy and energy production. Jeremiah, first of all, can you just talk about some of the problems with the way that we do it today?
Sure. Yeah. Well, the first two big problems you've already touched on. The first and the most obvious is that they pollute. Our main three power sources are coal, natural gas, and oil. And when we burn those, they just cause a lot of pollution. They dirty our air and our water. A new study published just yesterday said that air pollution kills about 3.3 million people every year, and that number is rising again at this point. The second big problem, you've already touched on it as well, is that they're finite. These are non-renewable. They're here today, gone tomorrow, forever. So it's a short-term fuel supply. And then, I mean, if you think about oil, think about how many thousands and millions of years it took for various organic matter, plant matter, animal matter, microorganisms to be transmuted over lots and lots of time into black gold that we burned through in just a few generations. I mean, we've gone through a staggering quantity of oil, of natural gas, of coal. In the case of oil, some say that we're very close to, if not right around the peak supply, which means we're approaching the downward curve there where it'll soon be exhausted.
In other words, the amount that we're extracting is the maximum amount that we could possibly be extracting at any one point, and the supply is going to, the fact that it's a finite supply is already going to start impacting our ability to extract it.
Yes, that's right. Yes, yeah, so it pollutes, it's finite, and then the third problem with these fuel sources is the economics of them. Right now, economically, while these non-renewable sources last, they are so cheap that they make it economically prohibitive for companies and countries to explore renewable sources. So in a global economic system built on selfish competition, where you've got each nation vying for dominance over other nations, and each company trying to have lower costs and higher profits than other companies, this is a serious problem. So I think that when you start to speculate about a utopian future and a time when we will be thinking about long-term solutions, it really seems unlikely that there will be any room for burning coal and oil and natural gas for those three main reasons.
So any thoughts on solutions? Would it be alternative fuel sources or a different mindset when it comes to consuming energy?
Well, I would think a lot of both. I believe that the mindset will be very different. I believe that, for one thing, we'll be moderate. I don't think you'll find a situation where climate control inside of buildings is as extreme as it is now in some cases. I think that we'll probably be fairly moderate with all of our electricity production and consumption. But then I also believe that there would be efforts made to go green, to find renewable energy sources and find ways to harness energy sources that are not finite. Things like solar power, geothermal power, wind power, hydroelectricity, and many others.
Yeah, the idea of, say, reducing the amount of climate-controlled buildings and so on, that seems like kind of a no-brainer in a lot of ways. If you're in a environment that is more conducive to human livability than Oklahoma is at this point, you're living in a world where the climate really is moderate, temperate. It's pleasant, and you're basically not dealing with extremes of heat and cold the way that you are in so many places today. That would have a huge impact just in and of itself.
It would. That would be enormous. I believe that for most homes and other facilities, climate control is zapping a lot more juice than lights or things like that. So once the climates are moderated, that would really reduce a lot of demand and
and consumption of energy.
You know, what you said about the fact that we consume so much oil and these non-renewable resources today, it just makes me think the fact that humans have managed to get along without these just fine for thousands of years, that we've essentially created this system that's extremely dependent on these forms of energy in very short amount of time. And the way that we think about it, it's like anything short of what we have right now would be a disaster.
It didn't take us long at all to get totally addicted to our modern consumer sort of a model and all of our modern conveniences. And a big part of that is just massive amounts of power. But I do think that there's a lot of a few developments on the scene today that can give us kind of a glimpse into what the future might look like when we do learn how to harness renewable, clean energy sources. Just this past July, there was a time period in Denmark when they produced 140% of the nation's energy needs with wind. 140%. So with the excess, they pumped that into the power grids of Germany and a couple of other neighboring nations. So that shows that wind power has come a long, long way. Now, it was just for a couple of hours, and normally it's not that steady, but it still can give us sort of a glimpse into the future of what wind power might be when the technologies are perfected. And then we've also made some really amazing advances with capturing solar power. There was a team of Australian scientists last year that achieved a record in solar efficiency. They converted over 40% of sunlight that hit test panels into electricity. The average solar panel in use today is only able to convert about 15% of the sunlight into electricity. So by jumping up to 40%, that was just a landmark development. And it really points to a potentially sunny future for solar panels, I think.
It's interesting, I guess, that I'm intrigued by this concept of combination of just learning how to use energy and what are appropriate levels of energy use. There's just so much wastage. There's so many ways where we use energy in ways that actually hurt us. They break down family life. You just put four people sitting around a dinner table. It's a wonderful experience. You put a smartphone in each of their hands and suddenly you have, you might as well all be in different rooms of the house. Let's remove the technology from the equation and improve our family life. It seems like there are a lot of instances where appropriate use of energy would involve just more judicious use of it. But then combining that with the idea of finding ways to get that energy that don't pollute, there would be a lot less overall need for it, I would think, and it would be better energy overall. Jeremiah, you've actually written an article about this in the current edition of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. You want to just tell us about that a little bit?
Yeah, the article basically just goes through some of the developments, some of the gains that mankind has made in learning how to harness renewable energies, solar, wind, and so on. But then it points out that we're still a long way off from these being viable replacements for our polluting energy sources. If you take an honest look at the big picture, you realize that it's still just way too soon to be sealing off the coal mines and powering down the oil rigs. And so the article just points out some of those economic problems and some of the environmental problems that still go along with a lot of these renewable sources. But then I spend the last little bit of the article just looking at the world tomorrow, just like we're doing on this program today, and just sort of speculating about what energy usage and power generation might look like at that time.
The title of that article is Will We Ever Master Clean Energy? This is the October edition of the Philadelphia Trumpet. You can find that online at thetrumpet.com. We're going to take another little break and we'll come back and talk about manufacturing and technology, a little bit about transportation and population management. We'll be right back.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
This is our program about a sustainable future. We're looking at how the way that we do things today is in many cases unsustainable and how that's going to have to change in the future. We're looking at potential solutions that'll make sure that our planet will be a better place for our children, our grandchildren, and beyond. We're going to get into technology now. We'll send it over to Dan Westerbaan. First, to just talk about some of the problematic practices we see today.
Well, thank you for having me here today. Well, some problematic practices that we see today is that we have all sorts of technology around us. Our world is just surrounded with all sorts of technologies. But are these technologies actually improving our lives? I mean, we know that every technology we see around us has a purpose, whether it's a bottle opener that opens a bottle for you, or if it's a 747 that flies you across oceans. We see that these things all have a purpose, and they have some sort of function they're serving for us. But do we even need them to fulfill that function and that purpose? In the world tomorrow, we're going to be basing our decisions on whether what we do, is it going to please God? Is it going to be beneficial to others? Is it going to be laying up an inheritance for our grandchildren? And so we're probably going to not have nearly as much stuff as we have. We're going to ditch our consumer society, but we're still going to need items. We're still going to need equipment to rebuild the earth, to fix up all the waste and decay that we see around. And we're going to need technology to do that. And so we're going to have to make some decisions on what kind of technologies we build. One thing we have now in today's world is we have planned obsolescence. This is when a product will fail after a certain amount of time, and there's still valuable life left in that product. And this mentality, it's just based on the way of get. And so it's a selfish mentality. Companies want to get more sales, so if their products fail, you're forced to go back to them and to buy that again. Consumers, they want to get a really cheap product, so they'll buy something that's been made with a whole pile of shortcuts taken, and then they want to just save as much money as they can. And so we have two people who both want to get. But if these people had outgoing concern, if they were living a way of give, the consumers would want to give a fair price for the quality that they're trying to buy, and the manufacturers or the companies that are producing these products, they're going to want to be transparent. And if anything broke on a product before it was supposed to, they're going to want to replace that or fix it so it still works for those people.
Yeah, it's not hard to see how manufacturers and technology companies, they're not interested in sustainability at all. They really are interested in trying to sell as much product as they can. And it's in their interest, actually, to create things that don't last. That's not a sustainable model. It seems like the idea that we would put limits on technology, that with each technology, we would ask ourselves, how much is this necessary for the improvement of life, or this specific question or the specific issue that we're trying to solve to make life better, supposedly? What are the ramifications? Are there ripple effects that we're not considering that could actually hurt our lives? And so many of the technologies you see today, maybe they solve that micro problem, but they have many associated bigger problems that come as a result of them.
Absolutely. One thing that comes to mind right now is just adding ethanol to fuel. I mean, we know if we take a car and we park it in our garage and we let it idle, that it's going to create some pollution. And if we don't have enough oxygen in that garage, we're going to die. That's a fact. But if you take a car that runs with an ethanol blended fuel and you park it in that garage, you let it idle, and you don't get enough oxygen, you're still going to die. It didn't solve the problem. It was just like this Band-Aid solution. We're trying to solve these problems that we can see and we can measure, but we're not getting a real solution. We just do this Band-Aid patchwork.
A lot of technologies, you could make a strong argument for many of the really amazing products that are extant now, and you could make equally compelling arguments against a lot of them. And when we think about this utopian future, this world tomorrow, the Bible doesn't give us all the details of all of that, but it does make two things inescapably clear. And the first of those is that as we've gone over, everything will be done in a spirit of giving, in a spirit of love, a spirit of long-term concern will motivate everything. But secondly, scientific understanding will be illuminated like never before. There's a passage there in Isaiah that says, the earth will be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. So God created this universe and the laws of physics that govern it and every aspect of science and technology. He knows all of that. and we will have access to all of his perfect and complete understanding. But that doesn't necessarily mean that we'll use all of that to build some incredibly high-tech world that's electricity saturated and just, you know, neon lights and hovercrafts and teleportation devices everywhere and whatnot. Maybe we will, but we might keep things simpler, because the real purpose is not producing technology, but it's producing God beings. And maybe God will find that it's simpler to do that in a more agrarian modeled kind of economy or something like that.
I do find it fascinating to compare human designed and engineered technologies with God designed technologies, where he manages to make things that when they fulfill their lifespan, they return to dust and they become new life again. They take new life. They take on a new form at some point. You know, they basically go back into the substance of the earth, and so many of them they are self-sustaining in a lot of ways. I mean, if you just compare an eyeball with a camera, you know, there's just many aspects of what an eyeball is able to do. And even to think of a camera that was able to, you know, last for 80 or 90 years and then go back to dust and have no waste, no toxins, nothing that would pose any kind of a long-term problem. It's really, really remarkable. It's a very compact technology, you know, that's extremely effective, and it's being used by everybody, and yet there's no side effects. There's no downside to it whatsoever. Transportation. There are actually prophecies in the Bible that talk about highways. I think there's some suggestion that there's going to be some kind of automobiles of some sort. What do you think, Dan?
Well, what I think is that we're going to completely change not only the vehicles we drive and the types of fuels they use, but we're also going to change the mentality of the drivers. Drivers are now going to obey a speed limit. And so as someone who's designing a car, I know exactly how fast they're going to drive, and I can make it a lot more efficient. I also know it doesn't have to be nearly as safe, because if there is an accident, that person will probably have started slowing down out of concern for the other person. So they're going to obey the traffic laws, and that's just going to make a huge difference in what I have to anticipate as a designer trying to design a car.
Well, I want to finish the discussion by just talking about population management. Herbert Armstrong wrote this in his book, Mystery of the Ages. Today, the greatest and most awesome problem of all is the population explosion. Growing populations in all nations are rapidly outstripping the ability of the world to sustain them. The daily ominous pressure of people is one of the truly incomprehensible problems today. And what I think is interesting about that is the reason that is the case is not because we don't have enough resources. It's because we're not taking care of the resources that we have. God, he created this planet with enough resources to sustain far more people than it has. When you look at the problems associated with population, he's talking about, you know, food supply and water resources and that type of thing, where enough people don't have those. Really, there is plenty to go around if we just manage it the right way. Now, population is an interesting question. You might not realize this, but throughout most of human history, under human environmental mismanagement, living in disobedience to God, for the most part, people had brutal lives, unsanitary, fairly short lives. For much of human history, life expectancy worldwide was somewhere between 20 and 33 years. So the population didn't grow very much. Now, there's been 6,000 years of human history. By the end of the first 5,600 years, that's like 93% of that 6,000 years, there were still only about 500 million people on Earth. But right about 400 years ago, something started to change. People actually started to keep the laws of personal hygiene and sanitation that God had delivered to Israel thousands of years before, like the one about how to manage your waste that we talked about earlier in the program. And so when people did that, they started to live longer. The death rate started to drop. They weren't staying cleaner because God said it, because that's what the Bible said. They wanted to discover those things on their own. But this is just an amazing historical example of how if you keep God's law, you're going to be healthier, you're going to live longer. Now, around 1800, the world population crossed the 1 billion people mark. 1 billion people. It took 5,800 years of human history for man to reach that threshold. 5,800 years. You know how long it took for mankind to reach the 2 billion mark? It took 127 years. The 2 billionth baby was born in 1927. It took only 33 years to reach 3 billion. That happened in 1960. And we made another billion people in only 14 years. We crossed 4 billion in 1974. So you see the pattern. The more people you have, the more people you make. And the more people you have making more people. We crossed 5 billion 13 years later, 6 billion in 12 years. Now, the rate of growth has slowed. It took 13 years to reach 7 billion. That was a few years ago. But just think about this. We produced four times as many people in the last 100 years as we did in the previous 5,900 years. And if you just think about the 20th century, it wasn't a happy century. We had two massive world wars, a whole bunch of smaller wars, several famines and disease epidemics and pestilence. And still over that period, global population went from about 1.6 billion in 1900 to 7.1 billion people at the end of the 20th century. Now, that population skyrocketing, that's not a result of people having more children. In fact, birth rates are lower now than they were during previous periods in history. But the difference is that people are living longer and they're having children that aren't dying. Now, when you look at this question in the context of world tomorrow prophecies, it becomes really interesting because the next 1,000 years, the 1,000 years that occur after Jesus Christ returns, they're going to be pretty wonderful. You're not going to have war, no famine, no disease epidemics, virtually no infant death. In Mystery of the Ages, Mr. Armstrong, describing the millennium, he wrote this: since people will be keeping God's health laws and spiritual laws, there will be no sickness, ill health, pain, or suffering. There would be, on the contrary, vigorous, vibrant, good health, filled with dynamic interest in life, enthusiastic interest in constructive activities, bringing happiness and joy. Imagine how that's going to affect the quality of life and lifespans and fertility. What's going to happen to the world population? Let's just be real conservative. If you started that 1,000-year period with a million people, I think that's a pretty small number. It'll probably be more than that. 1,000 years is about 33 generations of about 30 years each. So let's say every family has an average of 4 kids. That would mean each generation would have twice as many people as the one before. And let's assume everybody lives only about 75 years. So you'd only have about 2.5 generations alive on the planet at any given time. Do you know how many people you'd have if you just punch the numbers into a calculator? Well, after 500 years, you'd have 1 trillion people. And if you think that's a population problem, at the end of 1,000 years, you'd have over 852 quadrillion people. That's 23 million people on every acre of land on Earth as it is today, including the top of Mount Everest and the ice pack of Antarctica. So if that were possible, I think it'd be pretty uncomfortable. 23 million people on every acre. But it raises a really interesting question. The Bible says that God made the earth to be inhabited. It says that in the book of Isaiah. But he did not make it to be inhabited by 852 quadrillion people at one time. That is for sure. But that's what you would get if you had 1,000 years of very conservative factors of 75-year lifespans, 4 children per family, and good health. So how many people can the earth support? I think it's a good question, because if you look at it from God's standpoint, the more the better. God wants the largest family possible. Now, scientists who have tried to estimate the Earth's carrying capacity, the best estimates say that they think that it can support about between 10 and 20 billion people at a time. Now, right now, we're 7 billion plus. They say the most that we could really carry would be 10 to 20 billion. I'm certain that we can do far better than that. And I think really the answer to that question is the better we take care of the planet, the more people it can support. It's obvious that it can't support several billion people who all consumed and wasted resources as much as we do in America. It couldn't go on supporting large numbers of people who contributed to making deserts through ridiculous farming practices. We're talking about a world where people treat the planet with respect, where people are good stewards with the resources that God has blessed it with, where they're striving to live the way of give. They're striving to maximize the Earth's productive potential, not just for themselves, but for their children and for their grandchildren. What's going to happen? I think it's exciting to think about. The Bible says that God's kingdom is going to govern the whole earth. Like Jeremiah mentioned earlier, the knowledge of God will cover the whole earth like the waters cover the ocean beds. And, you know, there's actually prophecies that show that God is going to work some miracles that'll make more of the earth inhabitable. Today, only 29% of the Earth's surface is land, and only 10% of that is cultivatable. So not even 3% of the Earth's surface goes toward food production today. The Bible says that that's going to change radically. He talks about cities being rebuilt. He talks about deserts being reclaimed and blossoming like the rose. He talks about parts of the Earth that are not usable at all today being put to excellent use. Now, he doesn't say that humans don't need to exercise some ingenuity and elbow grease to make it happen. We're going to have to work to turn these abused areas back into usable areas. We're going to have to dress it and keep it like God instructed Adam to. But there's also a prophecy in Isaiah 41 that talks about a new sharp threshing instrument that will thresh the mountains and beat them small and make the hills as chaff. So this is talking about leveling the mountains in order to make more arable soil and more land that people can live on. I think that's just amazing proof that the Bible wasn't written by a bunch of backwoods camel herders the way that critics claim, because it's not even going to enter the mind of a man who's living in a world with only 200 million people on it. But God knew there would come a time when the planet really needed more space to really run at its maximum capacity, right to the limit of what it can support. We're going to need more space. So there's beautiful prophecies about this world being cleansed and being beautified and used in ways that are just absolutely spectacular. This is the wonderful world that we have to look forward to. The world tomorrow is going to be a world that gets better and better. And it's worth looking at our lifestyle today, our practices today, the choices we make today. It's worth evaluating ourselves and trying to make decisions that move at least in the direction of those sustainable solutions that we're going to see implemented worldwide very soon. If you want to read more about that future world, you need to read Herbert W. Armstrong's book, The Wonderful World Tomorrow, What It Will Be Like. It'll give you a more complete overview of what the Bible says about the state of the world, based on the Bible's prophecies of what happens after Jesus Christ's return, which is coming very soon. You can find that book online at thetrumpet.com, just under the literature tab. You can either read it there or order a copy, and we will send you one for free. The Wonderful World Tomorrow, What It Will Be Like. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Send us your thoughts or your questions by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. I want to thank my guests today, Robert Morley, Jeremiah Jacques, and Dan Westerbond.
You're welcome.
Thanks for having us.
And thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. And I'll leave you with this thought from Wes Jackson. If your life's work can be accomplished in your lifetime, you're not thinking big enough. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world. We'll be right back.
listening to Trumpet Hour on The Voice, 101.3 KPCG, and on the web at kpcg.fm.